This episode, I'm joined by Abdul Hakim Murad, who is an English academic, theologian, and Islamic scholar who is a leading proponent of neo-traditionalism. He's the founder and dean of the Cambridge Muslim College, and in this episode, we discuss his latest book, Travelling Home, Essays on Islam in Europe, alongside discussions on René Guénon, tradition, belief in the modern world, the work of Michel Houellebecq, and more. I'd like to say a big thank you to all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you would like to support Hermetics Podcast and keep it going indefinitely, which is very, very much appreciated, alongside getting access to some exclusive patron-only content, then please find links in the description below, alongside links of how one can join the community. Enjoy. Abdul Hakim Murad, otherwise known as Timothy Windsor, thanks very much for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
You're one of the bigger and more well-known guests who's come on. You know, the founder of the Cambridge Muslim College, the developer of the eco-friendly mosque there, which is an absolutely outstanding piece of architecture and just a beautiful building. But I guess for those that don't know of you and your work and what it is you do, just tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, it's a little bit difficult to summarize. It's been an inconsistent journey through life, I suppose. Educated at the usual kind of public schools in Cambridge. Then I took the plunge into Islam for reasons that you might want to try and tease out later on, and studied in traditional madrasas, seminaries in Egypt and elsewhere in the Middle East for the best part of 10 years. So I kind of wear two hats. I have a doctorate as well. And my day job is a lecturer at University of Cambridge. But I also thunder from the pulpit in the Cambridge Mosque and various other places. So I'm kind of amphibious, I guess. I try to get the best of both worlds.
I see. And I definitely will be delving into, your... So I'm right in thinking you converted to Islam, or should I say, that word, I guess, wouldn't be correct for those that have moved over to Islam, because that would, of course, been their home all along. It's just something they found. So you found Islam, fully at 19.
Yes, I guess so. And in a sense, it's an ongoing journey. The guy who I formally converted with gave me a stare and said, "You've won the battle. Now you must fight it." Which I thought was a bit of a depressing way of welcoming me. But it is true. Every day one has to reestablish one's convictions, one's relationship to God. Religion is a journey. It's not some kind of stasis. So one tries to be a convert every day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very critical of that word converted. It sort of buys into the modern attitude of quantity, right? All right, I've converted, I'm done, I am X, Y, and Z, and that is how I identify.
Yes, I mean, we can't really claim, and I hope we never have been able to claim, that we have a fixed and clear identity. We interact so much in a kind of osmotic and probably benign way with the environment around us, with the sun is shining today, so this interview might have been quite different if you'd done it in February. That's just how we are. So a conversion, yes, but of what? It's the question of subjectivity. And also, I think that conversion somehow indicates kind of swapping one way of being oneself for a quite different one, whereas the journey into Islam is often remarked upon as a kind of augmentation or even a turning within. It's not a kind of sudden born-again adoption of a completely different state of being. It's a different way of being oneself. I'm not sure I can express it more precisely than that, but you certainly don't feel that you've become somebody else, better or worse or the same. It's the same person, it's the same subject, but with a greater sense of comfort, reassurance, direction in the world. It may not be much more than that for many people.
Okay. So we're going to be talking about roughly talking about the ideas that come up in your latest book, Travelling Home, Essays on Islam in Europe, published June last year by Quilliam Press Limited. But before we do so, I do have to ask you the question specific to this podcast, the Hermetics question. You can place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation. Who do you pick?
Well, yeah, and I like the way you do this, and particularly that it's a trialogue rather than just two people facing off. it's not necessarily adversarial. It would be nice to bring in a medieval But I think there's too many cognitive dissonances involved in putting somebody from, say, 12th century Baghdad next to, some Damien Hirst or whoever. I don't think it would be a very easy encounter. It wouldn't make much sense. So I would pick 20th century thinkers. I would choose, I think I'd probably start with René Guénon, because of the impact that he's had on sort of the Western Muslim communities and thought. And I put beside him, probably opposite him, Heidegger. And then the third person, I think, would be Heidegger's French translator, Henri Corbin, who is one of the few Westerners who has really looked at Islam and Islam's metaphysical spiritual heritage as a trained philosopher. Most of the Orientalists basically stay with the text. They edit text, they translate text, they talk about influences and manuscripts, which is fine, but they often don't show how those texts might contribute to the epistemic or ethical crisis of modernity. And I think Corbin was the great exception, and he brought this kind of Heideggerian sense of the ongoing credibility of what happens when you try and collapse the sort of Cartesian self-other dichotomy and recognize our sort of integrity with the world around us. And the kind of, it's a sort of existentialist shock that comes out of that, which Heidegger thought pointed towards something that might supply for metaphysics, even if it wasn't metaphysical. But Corbin thought, yes, this is how we secular post-Christian Europeans who can't bear the void left by modernity have to go. The God-shaped space in the Western soul is just too big and painful. We can't live with this. And instead of looking at a local European resurrection of the dead European spirit, we look for him specifically at the Islamic world, and particularly the Sufi, Ibn Arabi, Iranian tradition, which in the course of his journeyings in the Middle East, he found actually to represent a living spirituality that was also philosophically very open to this sort of sub-mystical idea that Heidegger has of a kind of unified Dasein, an intuition of being. And then Guénon would no doubt interrupt in a very kind of Gallic and insistent way by saying, yes, the modern world is in a state of terminal collapse, but you have to find one particular external integral form of a major world religion. And really, for Guénon, it didn't matter a whole lot which one you followed, as long as it was intact. And he would point to Corbin's appropriation of this sort of religious hint in Heidegger as something that wasn't lived through properly in Corbin's life, because he was nominally still a French Protestant, but spent his life vindicating what he saw really as the truth of Islam and these Sufi Iranian texts. So I think he'd reproach Corbin for not really following through fully for whatever reason. So I suspect that none of them would be convinced by the position of the other, but I think they'd come to some of the really core issues about the current spiritual crisis of the West, the possible role of Islam in filling that God-shaped hole. I think it would be a good quarrel. Yes, I wish I could hear it.
Well, so I'm not familiar with Corbin, but I am familiar with Heidegger and Guénon. And the immediate thing I see there is, you know, as you mentioned, with the sort of the God-shaped hole that you're mentioning, and in Heidegger, this is filled in with, I'll put my skin in the game here and say often very loose terms such as authenticity, which yep. scholars, you know, repeatedly over the years have gone, I just wish Heidegger had told us what the hell authenticity actually is, because that seems to be the replacement, but it's a replacement mm-hmm. which lacks the substance of this transcendent meaning. Sure. And in sort of flattening his whole approach into this almost an immanent philosophy targeted towards putting death in front of you and just succumbing to this this existential crisis, you're constantly running around in circles. So I think the immediate discussion that I see happening in that room would be between Guénon's, what Heidegger may see as a retreat, almost in the Nietzschean sense of saying, you know, that he's Nietzsche said of Carlyle, you're weak because you went back to God. And then Gaynon, I imagine, would see that in the reverse. He would say, well, no, you know, your philosophy has this lost core, which you're constantly floating around, and he replaces with, say, you know, his times in his cabin with craft and things along these lines. But it doesn't, it never truly fulfills the entire, let's say, substance of the philosophy.
Yeah, and of course, particularly those of us who were opposing Heidegger in the 1940s, literally, tend to point very quickly, and I think correctly, to the fact that the non-theological nature of his thought led him into the lethal trap of looking for whatever might seem out there to be an interesting way of filling that hole. And it does seem that at least for a few years, he thought that if you marched around in a brown shirt, shouting certain slogans about manifest destiny of the people, that you'd get a sufficient serotonin rush to sort of fill that space. And that was, it was the downfall of his own people, really. Germany has still not really spiritually recovered from that. And I think that we may be heading that way again, if you look at the way in which the far right is trying to retrieve this authenticity from the ashes of what used to be Christendom, and reaching for things that are kind of fragmentary and not really representative of the best of the European peoples and the European story. If you look at Marine Le Pen in France, for instance, Alliance for Deutschland in Germany, and you know, this movement seems to exist across the continent. I think that's the danger of some kind of philosophized and quite urgent sub-spiritual urging that in the absence of truth, the real, reaches for something else. It's a bit like G.K. Chesterton, where he says, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything. Mm-hmm. And this is still, you know, a major threat, I think, an existential threat, if you like, to the integrity and the moral coherence of Europe.
I mean, yeah, that God-shaped hole, I mean, that seems to be the, you know, in the sense that you've said there, that we can't escape religious structures. If you leave one, you know, in quotation marks, religious structure, then you immediately form that belief in something else, whether or not you revere status, yep, or wealth or popularity. And these things are far more harmful than revering or worshipping a God, which, you know, the intention or the belief in which is actually, you know, not to sound too cheap, but wholesome.
Yes, I mean, this is George Steiner's thing, and I talk about his Nostalgia for the Absolute, which is one of his short books, in which he proposes that one can best understand Europe's secular messianisms of the last century. He includes Freudianism as well as Darwin and communism as surrogate religions that have managed to somehow metabolically and psychologically fill the space vacated by Christianity, but without having the possibility of sort of transcendence and spiritual literature, the monastic, all of that. And I think nowadays, and perhaps here I'm going to get cancelled very quickly, there is the possibility that some aspect of what is popularly called woke culture is starting to behave in a kind of orthodoxy, craving, coercive way that may be another vindication of what Steiner was saying, that the human soul abhors a vacuum. And if we can't put religion into that vacuum, then there's going to be some other set of certainties that sooner or later will be there.
But I mean, perhaps I'd ask you to expand on that. If I said something along the lines of, is what you're leading towards there that without a scripture, without a, you know, a religious structure, without these lines drawn in terms of belief, in terms of a historical fundamental religious foundation, then what seems to be happening on the left is that it's just a feedback loop. It just increasingly becomes more left, in the sense that this woke culture just doesn't actually know where to draw the line, because it's hitched its post to free-floating ideas, which it has to increasingly sort of keep up with.
Well, there is a certain tendency that you see amongst these possibly pseudo-religions to become ever more extreme until they finally collapse under the weight of their own contradictions. And religious fundamentalism can sometimes look a little bit like that. But I think the problem with these secular ideologies is that they do spin ultimately out of the Enlightenment. Part of the problem with many social justice warriors is that even though they're keen on decolonization, the ultimate philosophical roots of their position are entirely European and come from the Enlightenment, and hence are pretty impatient with the sacred worldviews of any non-European culture. I see it actually as another form of colonizing the mind on behalf of a Eurocentrism, that it doesn't really survive the two big challenges to the Enlightenment narrative of making the self the measure of all things, which come firstly from postmodernism, which deconstructs our sense of self and the subject, and on the other, and similarly, and in some ways symbiotically, the neuroscience, the kind of Daniel Dennett idea, which is that we don't actually have a consciousness anyway. That it's just a kind of automatic process in the mind that convinces us on some level post hoc that we have free choice and that we make decisions. Both of those new, almost orthodoxies in the academy certainly, are fatal for the Enlightenment attempt to liberate human will and human conscience. And I think that is one reason why many of these movements that come out of a very extreme, if you like, fundamentalist interpretation of the Enlightenment apotheosis of human self and human autonomy tend to ultimately run into the ground because of these contradictions, that the self is the measure of all things. How do I feel? The two-year-old child is invited to consult its soul to say, what is your whatever sense of self? But the human self is really not, even when we're adults, capable of huge decisions in the case of very many human beings. And if we're saying that those decisions are illusory anyway, then the entire contemporary secular project seems to be hoist on its own petard. It's a contradiction. And I think it's because of that deep contradiction that we see many of these kind of epiphenomenological, smaller contradictions emerging. For instance, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the concerns raised by all sides, but the current arguments between some feminists and some trans activists, which are currently very much at the heart of our culture wars, are an example of how these things, when they're pushed too hard and without respect for difference and non-closure, can result in hopeless conflictual paradoxes.
But do you think almost a return to a pre-Enlightenment, almost counter-Enlightenment reactionary form of the state or of government or of even in maybe in the Joseph de Maistre type sense of a government, which is, you know, in complete connection, almost a complete synthesis with the church, in the sense that everything that's in one local civilization is guided towards God. Do you think that such a return would even be possible? And if so, is that the thing which would lead us away from this, you know, theological reverence of the individual as God? You know, everything we do is everything we do should be targeted at absolute individualism.
Well, in terms of the public square and the politics of this, it's evident that we can't suddenly resurrect the Plantagenets or the Mamluks, that's finished. And the nature of the nation state is symbiotic with the enormous complexification and globalization of humanity. That the medieval state was very small, that the medieval kings didn't really interfere much in the Islamic world, they didn't even legislate, which kind of blows our mind when we think that's all politicians do in parliament. What else are they good for but passing laws? In classical Islamic law, the state doesn't legislate. God legislates. It's interpreted on a very local level, kind of subsidiarity type idea, by local communities. How you actually operationalize that in the context of a necessarily centralized modern nation state, it's unlikely, which is why, you know, one of the great works in Islamic studies in recent years has been a book by the sort of American Palestinian Christian author Wael Hallaq, a book he calls The Impossible State, in which he begins by outlining the current crisis of modernity and jurisprudence, and says the most brilliant legal ethical system that's ever existed is actually the Sharia of Islam. But you can't integrate it within the coercive structures of the modern nation state because it isn't state law. And that's why all of these movements in the Middle East and elsewhere that try to create an Islamic state by adopting, usually uncomprehendingly, the Western model, the Westphalian model of the state that monopolizes so much of human life, and to use that in order to impose a single unified interpretation of Islam just produces a kind of Muslim version of fascism, really. It's inauthentic and destabilizing. So I suppose I'm nostalgic. I love the kind of individuals I encounter both in the texts I use and in the traditional cultures which I have the good fortune to visit. I regard them as representing a superior form of humanity insofar as one can possibly judge and compare. But I'm not a nostalgic insofar as, you know, some of the right-wing French Catholics who think that they can bring back the Bourbons and everybody will go back to church again. That's not going to happen. And I don't think that can be part of a realistic contemporary political discourse, because that which is not realistic is always bad politics and bad philosophy.
Okay. Okay. So that the sort of supposed incompatibility of Islam and the West, which the right often sees, isn't in the sense of a cultural incompatibility, but is in the sense that in attempting to combine one another, Islam gets almost infected with a Western parasite, which fundamentally alters, you know, what it is at its core. It tries to almost appease the host, but in doing so, loses itself and becomes, as you say, sort of quite fascistic.
Yeah, John Gray, in the aftermath of 9/11, wrote this little book, Al-Qaeda and What It Means to Be Modern, in which he diagnoses the whole sort of Islamist radical project as essentially an epiphenomenon of the European story and something that doesn't have roots in Islamic history at all. I think that's quite a widespread view amongst Western analysts of what's happening in the Muslim world, the idea of an Islamic Republic, for instance. Khomeini thought he was going to, almost in this Heideggerian way, and I suppose Corbyn was sympathetic to part of what Khomeini thought he was doing, that he would return to authenticity, whereas the Shah had stripped that from the Iranian people by, you know, banning the hijab and making everybody clap and bow and wear Western clothes. But then he created this Islamic Republic, which is a very strange hybrid. The Republican ideal is precisely part of the Enlightenment populist sovereignty of the people reaction against a traditional religious order. And so from the outset, that thing was obviously not going to work, and it hasn't worked very well. And in many cases, you end up with the worst of both worlds.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, I mean, am I right in thinking that you consider yourself a neo-traditionalist?
Well, I'm not sure which labels will really work. Somebody of my rather composite and quite possibly very inconsistent position is sort of not on the left and not on the right, because I like traditional family values, I suppose. That might put me on the right, but then I'm also pro-immigration by and large, which would put me probably on the left. So I end up annoying everybody. maybe that's where a lot of religionists are at the moment, because the left-right dichotomy or axis is something that's come out of the French Revolution and subsequent evolutions. It's not something that's much older. There is something in religion that is actually extraordinarily concerned with the masses and with the people. And we think of, say, the medieval Catholic Church as being about silk-clad prelates and obscure debates over angels on the heads of pins. And we tend to neglect the fact that the great bulk of the church's social life was in creating hospitals and monasteries, feeding the poor, soup kitchens and so forth, and Philip Neri and those amazing figures. So if you like, that makes religion sort of popular, populist in a sense. And if it is to significantly push back against this apparently fatal spiral into neo-capitalistic inequality and increasing inequities of today's world, I think it's probably going to be more successful on a humanitarian and a compassionate level than by interfering in processes of political reform, which in their very nature tend to subvert ethics.
Okay. Do you perhaps see that that is one of the other places where there is, for many people in the West, under this, you know, as you say, a neo-capitalist or hyper-capitalist, almost, you know, neoliberal form of existence where basically people's identities often revolve around consumption or, you know, references to brands and things along these lines, yep. You know, are completely secular and materialist. Do you think that perhaps the incompatibility is that when people look at Islam and, you know, and some other Christian denominations, but I would go as far to say that certain denominations, even especially the bigger ones, Church of England, have succumbed to a degree to the form of mm-hmm. you know, the identity politics form of hyper-capitalism that's going on in the West. Do you think that people seeing that the incompatibility is that there isn't any, they've become that very neo-capitalist thing, they've become the capitalist individual, so when they look at Islam or sincere religious teaching, both ways, there is nothing in the other that would be of any use to them, in the same way that they're, you know, once you found the grace of God, for instance, that, you know, there's nothing greater that could be found in that neo-capitalist way of life.
Well, I suppose it's hard to generalize. The Church of England is a broad church, isn't it? And I suppose one of the sharpest points of its own internal culture wars, and that probably of most other Western denominations as well, has been the judgment that is to be made about, as Leslie Newbegin put it, the light in the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment took itself to be pushing back against the authority of the church. To what extent is there still light in that? Can Christians get on that bandwagon, which seems to be part of the course of history, almost a kind of inexorable Darwinian tide? Or is it their responsibility, as say, the Catholic Church until the Second Vatican Council officially taught that the past was better, the future is ominous, and that we need to witness to a confused and atomizing world by sticking to our guns, not changing the mass, not changing rules about fasting and clerical vestments and ordination, and that the church will be a witness, a prophetic witness, crying in the wilderness, perhaps, indifference, rather than trying to catch up with the sort of carnival float of modernity as it marches on to an ever more hedonistic or individualistic direction. And there have been voices on all sides of that debate, I think, in the Church of England as elsewhere. I took my family up to the Marian Shrine in Walsingham a few days ago, where you see the old school Anglo-Catholics in their medieval vestment doing their anti-modern traditionalist thing. But you can also find sort of people who think of themselves as very inclusive and accepting of all of the contemporary lifestyle choices, more or less, within one church, which is in many ways quite an achievement. Whether it really means that the Church of England stands for anything sort of more than a very small lowest common denominator, that's up to them. But of course, it is also an argument within Islam. But my experience is that Islam does feel more like a rock of ages, despite the sort of superficial political disasters that tend to occupy people's attention when they judge other religions on the basis of what journalists are reporting, which is what I guess most of us do. But if you look, for instance, at Stephen Bullivant's new book on Catholic disaffiliation in the UK in the last 50 years. He calls it Mass Exodus, which is a nice title for the book. And he seems to point the finger, although in a subtle and not absolute way, at the perceived reforms of Vatican II and particularly the changing of the liturgy. Mm-hmm. I'm not qualified to get into that debate myself, but except by saying that I sometimes take Muslim seminarians to the Vatican and they look at the different expressions of the liturgy and they're blown away by the beauty of the old Mass, even if they don't know Latin, which they don't, I don't, but it's a sacred event, whereas the newer things tend to be nice, but they're kind of, you know, what they call the Church of Nice. It's kind of, you couldn't object to anything, but it's not staggering. So in the Islamic context, I go into a mosque anywhere in the world, and I'm pretty certain, 100%, that I know what the liturgy will be. There's never been a conclave that has decided that it's going to engage in some kind of aggiornamento and it will be in another language, or that we'll have something else happening. And I think that's one reason, I think, for, despite its sort of superficial chaos, the Islamic religion continues to fill the, well, carpets, not pews, and is growing. So we have, for instance, we just finished our festival prayer here in Cambridge, not a very big Muslim community, but because of COVID, we had to pre-book spaces in the mosque on Eventbrite. And we had 1,600 places, and they went within about 7 or 8 minutes.
Wow.
Okay. That is a bit different to what you will see in, and I'm certainly not happy about, you know, declining Christian practice, because I think we should be supporting all religions generally nowadays. But it is a different different phenomenon. And those people who come to our mosque come in the confidence that what they will see will be what God and his prophet have ordained in its simple ancient majesty. The same language, everything will be that familiarity and that beauty. And I think maybe there's a lesson for Christian reformers here, that you don't necessarily make yourself more popular by trying to be popular. It's like you don't necessarily get more customers by reducing the price of your goods. Sometimes people are more impressed by goods if they seem to come at a high price. That's a high-risk strategy for religion, of course, and Islam does impose quite a lot. You know, you have to get up at dawn to pray every day of your life. That's not nothing. The fast of Ramadan, the Hajj, it's a considerable package. But that seems to be one reason why people continue to respect it, I think, because it's not trying to dilute itself in the face of the undoubted religious weakness of most people nowadays.
That sort of brings us back to what you were mentioning earlier with regards to, you know, postmodern society, the postmodern condition of the removal of, in abstract, you know, the removal of hierarchical structures or the father figure. And it reminds me of Slavoj Žižek's statement about how modern fathers become the postmodern father, you know, the father that's your friend. He no longer says, you know, we are going to your grandmothers. He says, would you like to see your grandmother today? It's okay if you don't. And in that, there's a sort of this passive aggressive you know, strange dynamic where any lessons that are given from authority are then ruined because you no longer trust the authority. And do you think the same thing then is going on in churches, that they've tried to assimilate themselves into postmodern culture, but in doing so have actually removed the very thing which kept people going, you know, for their heart?
Yeah, that may well be the case, that if you're an ordinary confused human being, you go to the place of worship and you speak to the sort of religious figure there and you want answers. You don't want options. You don't want the kind of whereas, or we have different possibilities for you. We're very inclusive, or the church has disagreed on this. You want an answer to your problem. And you may be happier even if you get the answer that you don't want. And it's clear, you know where you stand, then if you're given a range, a kind of spectrum of gradations and grey areas. And yes, that may well be the case, that the decline in the image of the paterfamilias is linked to that. And again, I think it does help to look at the science here. And I think that our new, very post-medieval understanding of the ancientness of the human species actually tends to help us with this, because not only can we see that human beings have always been religious, and the oldest structures from before Stonehenge have indicated the centrality of belief in an unseen world, interest in the sacrality of the natural world, interest in ritual. It's really fundamental to what human beings might be, but also reminds us of the kind of mammalian family structures, which are not, just because they're mammalian, necessarily what we should be doing as ethical, but nonetheless have a certain normativity. And we are experimenting in the West at the moment with some very post-traditional ways of arranging our sexualities, our relationships, on the basis of our own internal life and what we feel that we are and what we feel that we should be doing, in the hope that we'll get happier, even though antidepressant sales double every 10 years, so it's not working terribly well, but it seems to be where we are at the moment. But we find in, for instance, the movement of people converting to Islam, that one of the things they actually like, most converts are actually women, is this clear sense of, you know, the man is a certain thing, the woman is a certain thing, and they're both glorious, and but so different that you can't even say, well, just equal. They're kind of mutually superior in a complex kind of way. And the old ways, even where objectively from a modern perspective, they might not seem to be equal or just, do actually have the advantage of working and providing a good context for the bringing up of children. And a father is something and a mother is something, with different kinds of authority attaching to the two. And that may well be something that is linked to brain function, the way the species has historically adapted. But of course, even the concept of father, mother, birth parent is being challenged at the moment in ways that I think are going to hurt us more. So it's a huge experiment that our civilization is embarked upon at the moment. And the large question is, how far can we get from what seems to be the created or evolved normativity of our species before we face some kind of systemic collapse? We don't know. How plastic can the brain be? What happens to birth rates, for instance, if you've looked at Shanna Swan's book, Countdown? Mm-hmm. She's not coming at it from a religious perspective, but she's talking about the collapse in testosterone levels and sperm counts and birth rates across the developed world. And she does say different attitudes to what a woman is have inevitably had an impact on this, which is one of the paradoxes for our culture. So what Europe is facing at the moment, and again here, when, you know, if you're a Muslim, you're always in the middle of the controversy somewhere, is a country like Italy, mm-hmm. where the average woman has 1.1 babies. Mm-hmm. Every day, there's at least 100 Africans and Arabs crawling up the beaches because they've almost been drowned in the Mediterranean trying to get into Europe. And they're young and fertile, and that's the solution. But they're not going to be housed in those empty villages all over Italy. They're going to be kind of, well, nobody knows what to do with them. So this is increasingly one of the big challenges for Europe. And again, I talk about this in the book. There is a solution, almost kind of the natural world offering us a solution. But is it going to result in greater respect for other cultures? Because, you know, they're coming to contribute to our gene pool and to our economy. Or do we treat them as criminals? And sometimes Preeti Patel seems to imply that these people who are just trying to better themselves by getting across the channel are somehow criminals just by wanting to get into the country. I don't know, but much of the political future of Europe now, and America, which has its own issues on the Rio Grande, which is analogous, even though Islam is not involved, also has to face this. And it's going to increasingly be at the center of our political conversations, I think, for decades to come, which is one reason why the argument about Islam in Europe is so vital. And the point of the book really is to show ways, first of all, in which Muslims are integrating positively and contributing. The first three NHS doctors who died of COVID were all Muslims of migrant background. So where would our hospitals be without all of those rainbow of faces? They're indispensable, not just a kind of liberal choice to let in these poor people. Indispensable. Also exploring ways in which Islam's historic traditions of inculturation, Islam is actually quite different in its feel in different countries. And Bosnia is not Indonesia, is not Africa, can adapt to produce a genuinely British or French or Danish form of Islam, something that I think is already happening. So I think this is, you know, the stakes are enormous for the future of Islam, for its religious credibility, for the stability, for the demography, therefore for the survival of Europe. These are big issues. The book is trying to put in its two pennyworth. But I suspect the solution will just come from facts on the ground rather than academics in ivory towers vaporing away about what we ought to do.
But there's a very sort of deep, interesting paradox behind all of that in relation to the modern world, which is that we mentioned earlier, you know, that if you don't, we always believe in something, and of course, you know, quite literally, the vague and empty statement "believe science" is often touted around. Now, I'm not anti-science. It's helpful within its context, but you have to keep it within its own bounds. Otherwise, it becomes something often quite nefarious, and it can be used for nefarious aims. And as you said, you know, we have these statistics such as the increasing rate of antidepressant usage, the increasing rate of male suicide, also the decreasing rate of happiness in women who've aligned themselves with feminist ideology. And, you know, I'm not for or against or whatever these mean. These are simply statistics which people can look up. And in terms of them being statistics, they are supposed to be, in light of science, you know, an objective framework from which you would then change the course of what it is you're doing to make people not need antidepressants or be happier, etc. So it seems that in the face of everything that we've been doing for the last, you know, 100 or so years in the modern world since the Industrial Revolution, things have got provably worse. And yet we don't seem to actually use that science to make anything else. We just ignore that science.
Oh, yes. Yes, and it can even be censored. So a colleague of mine here in Cambridge tells me that her genetic research, and she's an atheist, would challenge some contemporary ideological orthodoxies. And therefore, she cannot pursue that research because she'd be Twitter-stormed into resignation. There'd be no chance. So there is a genuine ideological censorship and direction of science on a level that nobody can really estimate. But it does seem to be there. But yes, the problem is that indexing human happiness and fulfillment always seems to be such a subjective thing. And very often the kind of UN happiness index exercises tend to say, oh, New Zealanders are the happiest people in the world because they have more shopping centres and more dentists per head of population, and it becomes really very flat and secular. But how does one push against that? Well, again, in the book I talk about, for instance, the biggest ever academic utilization of this happiness of life scale, which is very often used by psychologists to measure human happiness and a general sense of wholeness and fulfillment in people's lives. This was done at the University of Mannheim a couple of years ago. And they actually found that in Europe, the people who score highest on this happiness of life scale are Muslims, followed by Christians of certain smaller denominations. Atheists are way down there. That was their conclusion. They surveyed more than 70,000 people. And this was kind of, I think it appeared in the Daily Mail in England as a kind of curiosity. But it's not something that will ever significantly influence the chattering classes or the kind of Hampstead set or the kind of Shami Chakrabarti type bien pensant ideological liberal, because it doesn't fit the narrative at all. But there does need to be, and I'd like to see it involving all of the religions, ideally, a kind of consistent pushing back against this obviously wrong idea that the meaninglessness of modern existence is somehow preferable to the deep meaning that the religions can give to their adherents, with measurable advantages in terms of mental health outcomes, for instance, as well as sort of family coherence, birth rate, and other things. And that is not understood. And generally the media culture, even the BBC, tends to view religion as something always to be problematized. Nowadays, if there's a Catholic priest on a BBC drama, 100% of the time he'll represent something negative. And this is a problem. But how you push back against that false, unscientific orthodoxy is going to be a challenge.
I mean, there was an interesting article recently, and the headline was so sort of almost obvious, I thought it must be being sarcastic, which was something along the lines of, during the lockdown, young men have been retreating to religion, and there they have found deeper meaning in their lives. And you think... You know, how is that a news story? And I guess this goes back to this, you know, what the definition of happiness is. And if you've been assimilated into this, you know, modern culture, then, you know, happiness is having the best holiday ever, or going on Instagram and showing off to all your friends that you're the, you know, the cream of the crop and having the fast car and the best job, etc.
Yep.
But these things can't fulfill you. And I guess when you're, you know, to sort of go on a meta level of that survey, not that I'm, of course, disagreeing with it, but it's telling that, of course, in asking anyone from their own context what happiness is, those who've developed some form of an understanding of happiness from the Christian tradition or from the Islamic tradition, these are the ones who are saying that their understanding of happiness has actually led them to happiness. Whereas people from the modern tradition are saying, yeah, we understand that happiness is this, 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 and this, and we just buy this, this, and this, and then we're happy. Oh, and by the way, we're really not happy. So at the same, yep, you know, they're, yep, not questioning their own mind.
Yes, and by the way, we're also destroying the planet, which is another thing, because it's not any of the world religions that are killing the polar bears and filling the Pacific with plastic. It's human greed and the attempt, as you say, to find happiness in bread alone and in material pleasures, and the ridiculous, almost geological impact that Homo sapiens now has on the planet. Of essentially, our main impact is that we dig up minerals in dirty holes in various parts of the world, ruining the environment. We turn them into products that we tend to use, not for very long usually, and then we bury them along with masses, mountains of other waste in other holes in the ground. That's really what Homo sapiens is doing at the moment. And the planet itself, this extraordinary, gigantic ball of sustainability floating in space, is becoming sick. I mean, really sick. That alone is a sufficient argument, if you like, against the modern world. You know, let the badgers have a vote, for instance. Mm-hmm. How do you support modernity if you're a hedgehog trying to cross the A14, for instance? It's very androcentric. And certainly in the Islamic tradition, where the Quran says that other species are nations like yourselves, and Islamic law and ethics is quite big on sort of respect for animals and animal welfare and so forth. You get that obviously in St. Francis, other traditions as well. But it's very much in our scriptures that if you say other species are nations like ourselves, then the principal function of modernity has been a kind of mass genocide of the other species, including many which are now completely extinct. So that, I think, is an argument that somebody like Guénon couldn't quite see, because he was writing really 100 years ago, even though I found in some of his writings some quite prescient anticipations of the environmental crisis. Even writing in the 1920s, he said, if human greed continues logarithmically to increase and the world's resources are finite, sooner or later the world will be destroyed. He was writing that in 1920-something, at the height of Western materialist triumphalism. Again, you know, I keep coming back to Guénon and finding his diagnosis and his predictions to be uncannily, terrifyingly accurate in many cases. But we're seeing it now. But still, the elite, the BBC, the chattering classes won't acknowledge the fact that this is a problem of materialism and a problem of our imbalance. And that the religions, with their teachings of asceticism and balance and restraint, really should be at the center of the collective human response, but they don't want to hear that, and they can't.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet, and
exactly.
But it takes a certain mind to be able to see that at what arguably was the absolute peak of Western life, which was, I would argue, along with Guénon there, the 20s. We didn't really get much better than that, other than having maybe some fancier little trinkets nowadays, which, you know, as you say, we bin very quickly. But I mean, this in your essay in the book Muslims and National Populism, you reference Hulenbeck, Michel Hulenbeck, who is the all in himself biographically, it seems, the archetypal sort of man who has just completely submitted to this Western form of nihilism. But equally from this, he has been able to sculpt in writing and in the form of his writing, you know, this almost apathetically submissive, lusting, hedonistic, just not, you know, you finish a book, I finished Serotonin and I had to go for a walk for an hour because it was just so utterly sort of bleak.
Only an hour,
but do you think there is a conclusion for this sort of Hulenbeckian nihilist? You know, is it even possible to sort of continue? Are you just, once you're in that, you're just doing whatever, it seems?
Well, I have to say I've always liked his writing, even though he's always been shockingly, outrageously rude about Muslims, Arabs, immigrants, whatever, especially in his earlier books, like sort of Atomized and Platform. And I always saw him as a kind of novelist, Goncourt Prize poster boy for the Islamophobic right. But I've also simultaneously respected his Sartrean awareness of the implications of nihilism, the belief that, you know, nothing has meaning at all, and even the meanings that we give to things are just a kind of ironic game that we might occasionally play and that we won't stick with. And I think that that razor sharp honesty about the tragedy of the modern condition in a kind of, I think, like Schopenhauer, in a kind of Schopenhauerian way, is quite a useful counterweight to some of the progress-oriented sort of utopian talk that you hear particularly on the left, that things are just so great and they're going to get even better despite all of the evidence. So I think he's a very useful corrective to that. And he does write in a certain French tradition. Merleau-Ponty, to some extent, was a bit like that. And his critique of modernity, you know, even... Yeah, somebody like Camus, I suppose. Where is morality if the Catholic God has retired? And I think you had a speaker on Jacques Ellul, is that right, on your podcast?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, I listened to a bit of that. I enjoyed that. And here's another person coming from that French world where he's kind of mingling a lot of philosophical traditions, including existentialism, but with his theology as well, dealing with this, and in many ways, I think, quite brilliantly, although Ellul, again, was kind of zealously Islamophobic in a way that I think was unworthy and based either on ignorance or kind of panic about the outbreeding of the Arabs in the ghettos or whatever it is that a lot of French people are hyperventilating about at the moment. I saw that as a very regrettable dimension to Ellul. But and then Welbeck, in his more recent books, and particularly his book Submission, which is about Islam, which is, I think, the book, is that right, the Gottinger Goncourt Prize?
Yeah.
And which I think has been quite well translated into English. It's often not easy to translate that kind of gritty kind of cinema vérité type French writing into English, but I think it does convey it. Rather well. And I don't take the book as being Islamophobic. Obviously, the subject is scandalous. This time it's not about the artificial intelligence taking over the world or clones taking over the world or everybody popping pills or some other dystopic reflection. It's about Muslims taking over France. Shock horror. Right? That's the worst outcome. That's worse than climate meltdown. That's the Antichrist. But actually what he does, and it's not clear whether he's trying to be outrageous or not, is that he presents it really as something that's a bit better. Here are people with a narrative. Here are people who have a healthy attitude to sexuality, which he thinks Catholicism doesn't. Here are people who understand what gender is at last. So he sees this putative Islamic future voted in somehow by some sort of strange parliamentary algebra as not a utopian future, but as something that has a certain grudging attraction. And the French intelligentsia is always, you know, it's not a love-hate relationship. It's more like a hate-hate relationship with Islam. But they've known that there have been significant French thinkers who found their way into Islam, much more than I think in the English. Well, whatever counts for sort of philosophical public intellectual class in England, not quite sure what it is. In France, it exists. And they're aware of Islam as an alternative. And, you know, there are people in the French elite who have converted to Islam, and that continues to happen. So it's seen as an alternative. And Welbeck is saying, well, what if? Because we're now draining the dregs of this ghastly materialism, and we're a bit bored of endlessly standing on the exhilarating edge of the void. Modern art is kind of the experience of standing at the edge of an enormous nothingness, which is kind of giddy and exciting, but it's always a bit samey somehow. If you go to Tate Modern, you get that experience 500 times and it's a bit sort of dull by the end of it. And he's recognized the fatigue, you might call it a nihilism fatigue, that is overtaking people, especially on the left bank of Paris, who've been in that state for so long, since Huysmans and his conversion, I guess, over 100 years, longer than for the Anglo-Saxons, certainly longer than for the Americans, and is saying, well, what happens if Islam, which we have in our ghettos, gets into that void? Let's just do a little experiment. So he's not really commending Islam, but is suggesting that Islam at least has something, that it seems to be the last repository of tradition, that it does have this remedy for alienation. So in a sense, he's sort of picking up on something that Guénon thought a long time ago when he said that, you know, the Christian thing in Europe, in Guénon's view, even long before Vatican II, was making too many concessions to modernity and was being diluted, and that the spiritual path for Westerners now has to be Islam. Which is not a verdict that a lot of Western readers of Guénon have admired. Steve Bannon, for instance, a kind of Svengali-like Rasputin of Trump's first year in power, was actually precipitated in his spiritual journey. Does he have a spiritual journey? Anyway, whatever it is, by reading Guénon. Mm-hmm. But of course, the Guénon thing that it has to be Islam is completely indigestible to somebody like Bannon. But that was certainly the logic of Guénon's very, very rigorous and absolute and certainly non-racial, non-ethnocentric, non-Eurocentric view. So it's a kind of vindication, if you like, in our latter days of Guénon's foretelling. But of course, necessarily the book, like all of, so many of his books end with a kind of suicide or some appalling dark thing, don't they, with Welbeck? Mm-hmm. But it's not really decisive. It's merely a kind of hint, an indication that in these European cities of darkness, there is that residual spark of light, which is the uncompromising Islam with its view of family, with its view of gender, with its view of prayer and God and fasting, which is still holding its ground despite being spanked and insulted by the left and right alike, still there. So, yeah, I used the book a little bit as an indication of where European thought might perhaps go when it's drunk the cup of Spinoza and Descartes to the dregs and is wondering what comes next.
I wonder if there is a question of sincerity there, though, because, you know, it reminds me of what you were saying about standing on the edge of the abyss of this nothingness, you know, and finally sort of getting bored of it. Yeah. Reminds me of Foster Wallace's little article where he writes about basically the West is now in this state of nihilism, which is like a party when your parents have gone away and you do absolutely, you know, you do all the drugs, you do drink everything, you do absolutely everything manic, you wreck the house. But then a couple more days go by and all of a sudden everyone starts to panic and realize, oh God, parents aren't coming back. Yep. And do you think there's something insincere about almost that you're retreating to religion as opposed to finding it, you know, out of one's personal search? You know, you're retreating because you go, oh God, I need some authority. Yeah. I need some guidance.
Yeah, I think that repentance is retreating, isn't it? I mean, Augustine's Confessions all about his retreating from the lower turbulences of his self, where the Quran says, flee to God. We run back to God because the alternative is the kind of flaming desert of our own stupid misunderstandings. So yeah, when people end up with religion because they find the outside world too much, sometimes that can be psychological, but very often that is the basis for a real repentance. And we shouldn't underestimate people if, for instance, they've been through drugs or something, or they're in prison and they find God, not necessarily a bad path back to God. It's a hard road, of course, to pass through that refiner's fire and to realize your own helplessness, but it's a good one.
Okay. We're getting on for an hour here. So, I mean, where would you advise, well, we didn't really touch on Sufism, but I mean, where would you advise one to begin with, I guess, you know, Islam generally?
Well, I think most of your listeners presumably have the wit to realize that the current fundamentalized or ideologized versions of religion nowadays, such as Hindutva in India or the religious right in America or ultra-Zionism or Islamism, don't represent the great historic spiritual depths of those traditions. So one has to set aside the froth that the media focuses on. Some people do find that hard. And then if you're looking at Islam, yeah, I mean, Guénon is a very good place to begin, even though in his amazing rigor, and he's certainly not a missionary, most of his metaphysical work is based on Advaita Vedanta, because he thinks that's a language that's particularly unvarnished and intelligible to the modern Western mind. But he preferred Islam for himself, and he recommended it to people because he saw it as being functional and also a Western religion, because it's Abrahamic. It even has a Christology and venerates the Virgin Mary. It's not as big a leap into Islam as it is into Buddhism, for instance, which is from a completely different cultural and imaginative sphere. So understanding that it is a cognate religion is really important. But one has to start ultimately from God, recognizing God, or the real, if one can't manage God and the monotheistic genius about personalizing the divine, if that's too much. Begin with the real, begin with the absolute, begin with the source of being, and then approach the Islamic texts, preferably the mystical spiritual texts, some of the classics of Sufism, and just see what's there. And it is a cornucopia of wisdom. And then take a look at a mosque and be staggered by the fact that the liturgy has never been changed by anyone ever. So if you're one of those kind of Lefebvreist Catholics who go on about we have to have the real mass, well, in Islam we don't have that problem. For all of our problems, our forms are intact, and that's one of its charms for me, I would say, that it gives me a form of prayer that I know comes from a great age of faith and that isn't contested by anyone, and I can inhabit and be uplifted by. Yes, and because it begins with God, it has to be accompanied with prayer, because God is the guide and we're blind, basically. We don't make good choices. Just ask for divine grace. Keep a good opinion of the founders of all the world's religions. Cultivate a sense of mercy for humanity and look at the disasters of modernity with the eye of pity rather than contempt. This was the way of my teachers always in the Middle East. They told me never to despise people in the West, however strange a place they might seem to inhabit. Always see what's best in them. Be compassionate, show pity, feel sorry for them, see what you can do to help them. And I believe that God guides people who are sincere, who have compassion for others, who overcome pride, to his path. And pride for Westerners is often a big thing. Guénon talks about this. Superbia, worst of the seven deadly sins. And often people read these writers and they say, yes, Islam is nice, but it's not my story. I'm a European and I do certain things. And those are people very often who have their noses in the air and can't bear the idea that the real truth or a saving truth might be next door. And that precisely is the kind of thing that, you know, Christ in the Gospels is preaching against. You sell what you give away, what you own, and never mind your affiliation, the way, the truth, and the life. You make any sacrifice. So generally, the West's resistance to Islam, I think, amongst educated people and spiritual seekers has been based on a kind of covert ethnocentrism. That it's not theirs. The Muslim is the Turkish taxi driver or the Bangladeshi waiter or the fundamentalist or the dark-skinned Saracenic other. Racism often comes into it, unfortunately. It's still a factor. So if people can overcome that, the worst of the deadly sins, and look at it with humility and see why Guénon is commending it and so many others trying to follow it, including some quite more people than you might expect in British society experience the value of it. Just open your heart and remember what the Prophet of Islam says, which is that the human heart is between two fingers of the all-loving God, and he turns it as he chooses. So conversion is only the kind of surface of things. The movements of the spirit are not in our hands, and we have to trust God to move us in the right direction.
Okay, okay. Whereabouts can we find your latest book?
Well, it is on Amazon, predictably. There's a Quillian Press website as well, which has some reviews and so forth. But yep, it's been out for a few months now, so it is, I hope, readily available in our click and collect age.
Okay. Abdul Hakim Murad, thanks very much for coming on. That was a
Thank you.
Beautiful conversation.